on the team that hired Mike and Monica, Monica Beamer and Mike Crenshaw, who just have been fabulous station co-managers. And now Mike has stepped aside from that position and Monica continues on, and we're absolutely thrilled and honored that she's running the place. She's doing a fabulous job.
Hopefully she's listening to this right
That's
now.
That's right. We love you, Monica.
So we only have about a half minute left. Is there anything else that that you would like the cable listeners to know about you or the board or the station or anything else? Yeah. Now's your chance.
Well, I really encourage, if you're out there and you're thinking, I wouldn't mind to run for the board, I would say if you really love KBOO and you really have the time, a lot of people run for boards, but they don't really have the time to participate. You know, but if you have time and the vision and the love to run, I really encourage you to do that. It doesn't take a special degree. It doesn't even take special skills. What it takes is passion and time and commitment. And of course, it helps if you have a background in finance or whatever. But it definitely, if you want to run, you should just go ahead and run and let people know about your love. And maybe you'll get elected. And it's a great way to support and help KBOO.
Well, thank you very much, Jen. Hopefully when things get a little more settled around the home front, you can come back in and get even further involved. Jen Davis is a current member of the KBOO Board of Directors and perhaps future member as well. That's it for KBOO, for news from the BOO tonight. We will hear from all of you, and you will hear from us again next Wednesday after the news. Have a great night.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, The Case of the Three-Sided Dream, showing Wednesday, June 15th at 7 p.m. The Case of the Three-Sided Dream tells the story of a multi-instrumentalist, Rashawn Roland Kirk, who went from a blind infant to a child prodigy to adult visionary to a political activist and finally to a paralyzed showman. Kirk was a seemingly superhuman musical force who played literally until the day he died. Again, that's The Case of the Three-Sided Dream, Wednesday, June 15th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with citizen scientist and master gardener Adrienne Fisher about reconciliation ecology and how her neighborhood used wild plant gardening to not only connect two wildlife preserves on either side of her, but also to connect a bicontinental migration route for innumerable wild species.
You can plant native flowering plants in your backyard and watch the biodiversity increase. And I did this my very own self. When I started gardening, my yard had grass, and it had a maple tree, and it had annuals along the edges. And I started to wonder, why do our yards have to look different from the savannas? What's the deal? Why do I have to go away to go see birds?
To be there. Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Aguanu listeners, Golazikawoba, welcome and greetings to you in my native language. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawn Land, Bunawabskek territory, in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. And I'm joined today by my amazing co-host, Miss Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Well, hello, Sherry. It's so great to connect with you and hear the words of Dawn Land and the Penobscot River. It brings my mind back to Maine every week when I say hello to you. This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we're going to speak with Adrian Fisher, who is a sustainability coordinator at a community college in the Chicago area. She's a writer and gives talks about regenerative gardening and reconciliation ecology, which I personally am very excited to learn more about. She's a featured writer on resilience.org, which is where I found this great article she had written called Ethics and Ecosystems Interactions, Why Reconciliation Ecology Matters. And for all of our listeners, we're going to ask lots of questions about that today, so just hang on to your hats and welcome to the show, Adrian.
Oh, hello there.
Welcome, Adrian. It's so nice to have you with us today, and there are so many questions that we have for you. This idea of reconciliation ecology, I know, is a branch of ecology which studies ways to encourage biodiversity in these human-dominated systems. And my understanding is that a gentleman named Michael Rosenzweig first articulated the concept in his book Win-Win Ecology, which says that essentially there's not enough area for all of Earth's biodiversity to be saved within these designated nature preserves. Therefore, humans should increase biodiversity in their dominated landscapes by managing for biodiversity in ways that do not decrease human utility of the system. It's a win-win situation for human use and nature biodiversity. That's a mouthful. I'm hoping that you can break this down a little bit for our listeners and explain to us, what is reconciliation ecology?
Basically, reconciliation ecology is, I like to think of it as making room for nature, because if you look at the way we tend to landscape things, and I speak largely from a gardener's perspective. I'm not an ecologist and I'm not a scientist, but I'm what you might call a citizen scientist and very much a gardener, and also a volunteer restorationist in our forest preserves. And all of these things, my background has taught me that you have to have room for nature. There has to be room for all of the myriad species that we should be sharing our area with, whatever our area is. For you, it's the Penobscot, and for me, my river is the Des Plaines River. And it's hard to think about, because if you look around your average suburban landscape in the backyard, you might see some grass and some Norway maples and a few bushes, maybe three or four species of plants. And because of just the three or four species of plants, which, by the way, are not native to my area, and I'm speaking from a Midwest point of view, you will not see a lot of birds. You will not see a lot of pollinators. You will not see, if you could look under the ground, you would not see a lot of the kinds of life that occurs under the ground, especially if that landscape is being managed through chemical means. Or if you go out into the country, and again, I'm speaking of Illinois because that's where I live, you'll see literally thousands of acres of basically two plants, corn and soy. And again, you will not see birds. You will not see a lot of mammals. You will not see the pollinators that should be, you know, you won't see the monarchs. And you will have a lot of chemical runoff. And so what we've done, basically, is hijack literally millions and millions and millions of acres just on our U.S. continent alone, which has taken away habitat from the millions of other species that we share our space with. And so what reconciliation ecology is talking about is
getting back some of that room, and there's a and giving back some of that room, and there's a lot of ways to do it, from built structures like chimney swifts. You can build towers for chimney swifts, or one of my favorite things is there's a bridge over the Des Plaines River where barn swallows live, because the undergirders are just the right size for them to put their little nests in, and then they can swoop down over the river and catch insects. And those, you know, you can do that deliberately with built structures. You can do that with the way you manage your agriculture. You can do it with how you garden, how you landscape. And so, to me, reconciliation ecology is a big umbrella term that covers pretty much all of human endeavors in terms of where we live.
Well, this is kind of a very exciting topic for me to investigate and explore with you. I likewise identify as a, I don't know if a citizen scientist, anyone would actually call me that, but maybe a citizen ecologist or a citizen gardener for sure. And these ways that we as regular ordinary people can help increase the resilience of our biosphere are always really interesting to me. One of the things that came to mind as you were talking is that my partner and I had sat down and we were thinking about oranges. So if you go up the Central Valley of California, you see probably thousands and thousands of acres of just oranges. And underneath the oranges, there's no grass, there's nothing, it's just dust. Because they're spraying for everything. They're spraying insecticides, fungicides, herbicides, and it's a monocrop. And so every year they bring in bees to pollinate the orange groves because they need to have bees to pollinate them. Whereas a natural orange tree just growing out there in the, you know, wherever orange trees grow, they'll be pollinated by dozens of different kinds of pollinators. But in the orange groves of California, they no longer exist, those pollinators, because they're spraying insecticides that kill them all. So now the bees are dying off because of the chemical use, and we're into this mad scientist vicious cycle of just destruction of an ecosystem. One of the things you mentioned when you were just speaking was this win-win situation, and that increases human utility and others. Species utility, and this notion that when we work with nature, we're not losing out. That's a myth that came with modern agriculture, that we have to have monocrops and domination to actually have the best production. But what organic gardening and gardeners and ecologists are finding is that all of life have emerged in a complex ecosystem, and many of those beneficial interactions actually create the best product or outcome for the entire ecosystem, and also for that specific plant that we're so attached to, like, say, our oranges. Well, can you share any stories about this, about how human utility can actually increase when we pay attention to how these ecosystem interactions occur?
Oh, yeah. There's all kinds of examples. Out in California, I don't know about orange groves specifically, but there are farmers out in California that are actually planting hedgerows full of native Californian plants that not only encourage pollinators, but they also encourage predaceous insects, because predaceous insects like to live in woodier plants. And then those insects go into the fields because they border the fields, and they can help keep pest insects down. And that's just one way that farmers are doing it. And Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation, they have a great website, and they have a lot of really great books about how to make these kinds of hedgerows and how to increase pollinator habitat. And that's just one example. There's really kind of a whole revolution going on, even in government agencies, about how we should be farming that we don't necessarily hear a lot about. The National Reserve Conservation Service is part of the USDA, and yet they are educating farmers about organic farming, and they're educating farmers about cover crops and not using pesticides and including habitat for pollinators in their farms, and all of this wonderful stuff. And the information is all free. Anyone can listen to their webinars and hear what they're learning and how to put it to use. And the thing about pollinators that's really important to remember is it is the pesticides, but it's also lack of habitat, and that leads to malnutrition almost because they're not getting enough of what they need, and also to just pure decline, especially of native bees and other pollinators. There's close to 4,000 species of native bees in the U.S., and we focus on one non-native species because it's most useful to us in terms of it makes, you know, honeybees make honey, and they're good pollinators. But actually, for example, bumblebees pollinate tomatoes much better than honeybees do. And we have native squash bees that are specifically co-evolved with squash and pumpkin, which are native plants. And they're native bees. They're native solitary bees, and you can't manage them. And all you can do is try to provide good habitat. So in the orange groves, for example, if they were to reduce pesticide use and also provide more habitat, it could support a year-round population of pollinators, and then they wouldn't have to import honeybees from elsewhere in order to do that job, or at least not as much.
Human beings occupy about 95% of the earth right now, and all of these other species, as you're talking about, are being enclosed into smaller and smaller areas. And the more that we as human beings continue to contribute to the loss of habitat, the more species are being lost. We're losing species right now at an unprecedented rate. And these kind of traditional conservation methods of creating nature preserves is really a failed idea, that you can't have small habitat reserves and try to preserve the Earth's entire set of ecosystems like they were a museum display. And so when we talk about this idea of reconciliation, which is the process of restoring relationships, we have to be willing to look at how we as human beings restore our relationship with the entire creation, with the entire ecosystem, our local ecosystems, and then the larger ecosystems that surround us. And so in the work that you're doing, is there anything that addresses the need for us to address our human-centric ideas about how to resolve these issues and to kind of step back and to allow nature to take the lead? We don't need to make space for nature. We need to be able to respect our space within nature. And I think that that's kind of the problem that we run into, is that we have this elevated idea of our importance within the structure of creation. And so in your work, do you address that issue at all? Do you look at the fact that we have these elitist ideas of as human beings of our place within creation and the importance of our place within creation?
First of all, I think conservation, as much as possible, is a great idea. I think the more we can conserve, the better. And by that, I mean, yeah, we have reserves. Let's have more reserves. Let's make sure that there's corridors between reserves. The thing that's difficult about reserves is that they're islands, and there's something called the species area relationship. And basically, it addresses what you were saying, which is if you have an island or a small area, species are going to start to go extinct because the amount of space really matters for diversity. And so you can have three or four fragmented little nature reserves and species will start to go extinct. But if you have those same reserves connected by wildlife corridors, there's more room. Different animals and plants can actually migrate. And this is important for two reasons, which is, for one thing, that it automatically makes more space and there's more reproductive success and there's more diversity. And also, because of climate change, things aren't going to be the same. Things are already not the same. And we might have a series of reserves where they're not really suitable for the species we were trying to reserve them for. And so that's why corridors are so vitally important. And that's why, for example, out west, there's those corridors that are trying to connect the great parks in the Rockies, for example, so that the grizzlies can have room to move. And I don't know very much about that because it's not really my my area, but it's the same principle interacts wherever you are. However, as you point out, we dominate one way or another the whole planet. We live in what has been described as the middle landscape, which is human-dominated landscape. And the only way that we're going to help save biodiversity is by converting large portions of that middle landscape to something that encourages that biodiversity. And that does, as you point out, require a huge change in how we perceive the Earth and how we perceive our relationship to the Earth and even how we perceive what we do with the Earth. Some of those changes are starting to happen. Many, many faith groups are starting to incorporate, I guess you could call it, green theology into their teachings. A lot of people are very excited about when the Pope released his Laudato Si teachings on climate change. I myself happen to be a Quaker, and care of creation has been embedded, it's been baked into Quakerism since the very, very beginning, along with a lot of concern for human rights and other things. And it's an idea of radical equality. And the early Quakers were always getting in trouble about that because women would preach, for example, or they were their first ones who were against the slave trade. And there was also always an ethic of the earth and its gifts are gifts for us. The creation is a gift, and we have a responsibility to take care of that creation. And so for me, it really is a spiritual and ethical and moral endeavor that fuels all my work. And one of my favorite books is The Sunflower Forest by William Jordan. And he talks about religion. That book is specifically about ecological restoration, which is also a very, very important discipline and part of reconciliation ecology. And he says, religion is the art and discipline of dealing with the problems of relationship at the psychological and spiritual levels. So his idea about religion is specifically in terms of creation is not, I guess you would say, God-centered exactly, but it's dealing with how do we relate to our surroundings and our spiritual urges. And I know people, like one of my really good friends who I do some rare plant monitoring with him, he's pretty much an atheist, and I'll say stuff to him like, well, you know, don't you feel some responsibility for taking care of creation or taking care of the woods? And he says, responsibility, what do you mean by that? And yet he's the one that's out there every weekend doing restoration work, doing this rare plant monitoring. And so there's some kind of relationship that he has, even if he's not willing to articulate it, that I believe is in that realm of the spiritual managing of relationship with nature. And a lot of people don't experience that. Either they've been cut off from nature since they were young, and they're afraid of nature. They're afraid of going out in the woods or whatever. Even very tame woods like we have around here, we don't have any big predators, and there's marked paths, and there's like no way you're going to get in trouble, but people are afraid of that. Or people are indoors all day, and they just don't get it. I used to be an instructor here at the school before I became the sustainability coordinator, and I taught some environmental issues in some of the classes that I was teaching. And one thing we would talk about, I had a whole project about urban sprawl, and the first thing I had to teach the students was that the suburban landscape that surrounded them, which, as you recall, is three or four species of non-native plants, usually very manicured, very, very trimmed, was not natural. They didn't even have a concept, really, of other kinds of landscaping or biodiverse landscaping or what that would mean. And so that was a very interesting conversation that I would always have with my students.
Can we dig into that a little bit? Because it brings up a question for me. One of the biggest user of Roundup in the United States is not actually agriculture, as people suspect, but rather lawns and landscaping, particularly the very large commercial landscaping that goes on around corporations and golf courses and shopping malls and parks and rec, actually. People don't know that, but most parks and rec departments in the United States spray Roundup on that lawn that your kid plays soccer on. It's an amazingly shocking fact. You wouldn't drink the stuff, but you let your kids roll around in it. My question for you, though, is about that landscape and the reimagining of the landscape. What does that look like? How does that start to shift specifically? So let's say in like your area of just outside Chicago, which is an urban area, how would that area look different as we start to shift towards integrating more species into our urban landscape?
Well, that's right where I live and work, and that's what something I'm really, really excited about. And where I live, it's already happening, actually. I belong to an organization called Wild Ones, which is a native plant landscaping association, and anybody can join, and they offer a lot of educational resources. And it's basically devoted to the idea that you can landscape around your home with native plants, with biodiversity, and you'll be amazed at what happens. And I have a lot of stories to tell about that because I've been doing that particular thing for many, many years. And I could start with my own backyard, where I have somewhere between probably about 120 different species of plant in my backyard. And my house lot is 35 feet wide by 150 feet long, and it's got a house and a garage on it. And so you can imagine that my gardening space is not that huge, but yet I have over 100 species of plant. Now, in Illinois, half the plants of Illinois in the Chicago region are non-native. They've been introduced. And only a handful of those are what we would call invasive species that really have to be controlled. Most of the rest of them you can kind of live with peacefully. And indeed, when we're restoring in the woods, there's a lot of non-native plants that we just kind of, don't worry about it. So this idea of trying to become totally pristine, back to what it used to be, isn't exactly correct. But for backyards, it's remarkable. You can plant native flowering plants in your backyard and watch the biodiversity increase. And I did this my very own self. When I started gardening, my yard had grass, and it had a maple tree, and it had annuals along the edges. And as I became more interested in gardening and more fascinated, and I started to wonder, why do our yards have to look different from the savannas? Why is there such a cutoff? What's the deal? Why do I have to go away to go see birds? And I became a master gardener, and I started experimenting. And then I quit being a master gardener because the advice was a lot centered on ornamental exotics and pesticides, so I kind of quit doing that. But they've changed, but I'm not going to go back to it. But anyway, so I started planting native plants and learning, and I was kind of stumbling along because I didn't at that time know anybody who was doing this. But the amazing thing that happened was that I noticed after I started putting in these prairie plants and savanna plants and some native shrubs, there were like these little insects flying around, which weren't there before. And then I discovered that they were bees, and they weren't just honeybees, they were bumblebees. And then I discovered that in my very own backyard, I have six species of bumblebees that visit my backyard. And the same thing happened with the birds. And what happened with the birds was I started planting native species like cup plant or echinacea, things you see all over the place. But what you don't maybe know is that goldfinches love echinacea seeds. And so then I started seeing these little tiny goldfinches sitting on the plants eating the seeds, and I had never seen that before. And so it's like this whole process of discovery that's the most wonderful thing. And in my town of Oak Park, there is a Wildlands chapter now, and we've registered over 250 native plant gardens in Oak Park, and more people are joining in. Even if it's just a few, it's like a little flower bed with commonly available natives. The thing that happens is that we're connecting Columbus Park on the east and the Forest Preserves on the west. And so by having a lot of native plant gardens in Oak Park and River Forest, which is a neighboring town, it adds a corridor, like I was just talking about, for birds, for pollinators, possibly for certain other kinds of mammals, which I haven't really looked at. And it increases the habitat so that you don't have these two islands anymore. You've got islands with something in between that species can travel from one to the other. And the other thing that's really important about that is that it's not just local, but the Chicago area is a really vitally important flyway for migrating birds who are coming back and forth between South America and Canada, or the southern United States and Canada, or even coming from South America up to our region. So by us planting these native plant gardens and having our trees and having places, food, shelter, the migrating warblers and the other birds have a good place to stop off. And so we're actually, our little town is impacting ecology on a bicontinental level. And it's really kind of exciting to think about. And no, I'm not doing it all by myself, but if a lot of folks are doing this, then it's going to make a big impact.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence.
Where are the bees going? Bees, where have you gone? I'm sending out a prayer for you. Please come back to the farm. Please come back to the farm.
Welcome to this week's Nonviolent Minute. We've covered a number of topics on this show, and this week we had the opportunity to speak with Adrian Fisher about reconciliation, ecology, ecological interactions, and our connection to the world around us. Deep ecology is an ecological and environmental philosophy that also promotes the inherent worth of living beings, regardless of their utility to humans, plus a radical restructuring of modern human societies in accordance with such ideas. Deep ecology argues that the natural world is a subtle balance of complex interrelationships in which the existence of organisms is dependent on the existence of others within ecosystems. Deep ecology's core principle is the belief that the living environment as a whole should be respected and regarded as having certain inalienable legal rights to live and flourish, independent of its utilitarian instrumental benefits for human use. It describes itself as deep because it regards itself as looking more deeply into the actual reality of humanity's relationship with the natural world, arriving at philosophically more profound conclusions than that of the prevailing view of ecology as a branch of biology. The movement does not subscribe to anthropocentric environmentalism, which is concerned with conservation of the environment only for exploitation by and for human purposes. Since deep ecology is grounded in a quite different set of philosophical assumptions, deep ecology takes a more holistic view of the world human beings live in and seeks to apply to life the understanding that the separate parts of the ecosystem, including humans, function as a whole. This philosophy provides a foundation for the environmental ecology and green movements and has fostered a new system of environmental ethics that advocate wilderness preservation and simple living, which is essentially the way of life promoted and adhered to by numerous indigenous cultures around the world. Reconciliation is the restoration of friendly relationships. It is essential for us to restore our friendly relationship with the entire creation. This is what reconciliation ecology does. It helps us to restore our relationships with the natural world. The question is whether we can develop common understandings that enable us to work with civility toward harmony with other creatures and beings. We here at Love and Revolution Radio believe that we can. And we hope that you will join us in creating this common understanding so that we may all walk into the future together with our ecosystems and our relationships with all of creation intact. Reconciliation, as I stated before, is the restoration of friendly relationships. It is now essential for us to restore our friendly relationships with the entire creation. And now let's go back to our discussion with Adrian Fisher.
This week's featured musician is Melissa Crabtree. This is her song, Bees, from her album, The Day I Fell Into the Water. You can find this and other music by Melissa at www.melissacrabtree.com. And now, let's return to our program.
I think that this is a really wonderful discussion, and I think it's encouraging to many people who are worried that the sky is falling, that there are real practical things that we can do. Because what you're talking about really is the need for us as human beings to kind of back off and look at the ways that we change and transform the lands that we occupy in ways that are a threat to other species, and to be able to make them over. The simple addition of native species of plants, ground cover, you know, in some instances for certain birds, they need a certain amount of cover in order to be able to thrive, so that both we and other species can be supported within those environments. It's something that every one of us can find one simple thing that we can do within our own environment to be able to create these changes that actually is going to allow other species to flourish, which in turn allows us to flourish more comfortably on the earth. And one of the examples that I saw was about planting hazelnuts instead of cotton seeds, where the specific hazelnut tree doesn't need pesticides. So more bugs, birds, and frogs will occupy the area. They keep their carbon dioxide contained since the trees aren't harvested every year. The roots seek nutrients all year round, keeping harmful effluents from leaching into the water. There's all these beneficial aspects of doing this. So it just takes a little bit of research on our part. It takes a little bit of effort. But there are ways for us to be able to manage our overuse and our misuse of the land, and to start reconciling and restoring those areas so that they're more habitable for all species in that region. And I think that that's really, really exciting. One of the other things that you're engaged in is this practice of regenerative gardening. And I would love for you to tell our listeners what regenerative gardening is and how you are engaged in the process.
If I could go back to a previous thing you asked me about just for a minute, you know, you talked about reciprocity, and that is a huge part of my own ethic. And I learned a lot about that from the writer Robin Wall Kimmerer, who she's Ojibwe or Chippewa. And her book, Braiding Sweetgrass, talks a lot about the idea of reciprocity and giving back and making sure that what you're doing is helping the earth regenerate, really. You know, she talks about the ethical harvest of only taking so much, so much is for the animals. And she talks about a lot of other kinds of ways of thinking of the earth or thinking of our landscape in terms of giving back, because we are given so many gifts. And that, to me, relates to regenerative gardening. That's another sort of big catch-all term. One of my favorite people, I've never met him, but I would love to sometime, is Eric Tonsmeyer. And he wrote Paradise Lot, and he just came out with a giant book called The Carbon Farming Solution. And that's what he's talking about. He's talking about gardening and farming in a way that actually makes the earth healthier. And we think of agriculture and gardening as being always destructive. it's always going to deplete the soil. It's always going to be overgrazed. We're always going to cut down the rainforest or wreck the prairie in order to do agriculture. And he and other people like him, the Rodale Institute, and a lot of folks are working on this, are saying, no, you know, regenerative agriculture is possible. And we can show you how it can be done. The Rodale Institute just published, well, it was last year, a white paper on how soil health, which is a whole other amazing topic to talk about someday, can actually sequester so much carbon just through agricultural practice. And so that's regenerative. You're helping regenerate ecosystems through your agriculture. And so since I'm always trying to think about people living at home, I mean, farming is 2% of the population, right? So most of us live in towns or cities or whatever. And so I think, okay, that's what I'm doing, regenerative gardening. I'm gardening in a way that's making the earth healthier, the soil and the animals and everything like that. And that can include food gardening. I do not have a food forest in my backyard. I know people who do. It's very easy for me to get food, so I made the decision that probably what I need to be doing is providing more habitat. And so that's what I'm doing. But permaculture techniques, if they're used intelligently, can be used very usefully for regenerative gardening. And obviously, you stop using the pesticides. You start using perennials. You start taking care of the soil. You start having room. Even if you are food gardening, you have room for your pollinators. I always tell community gardeners, okay, it's great. You've got all these boxes of dirt where you're growing your vegetables and everything, but where's your pollinator row? How are you providing habitat for your pollinators and your predaceous insects? And most of the time, a lot of times they say no, or they'll say, hey, yeah, we should be doing that. And so that's some really good dialogue that can be going on, because they're doing great stuff by growing food at home. And I grow a little bit of food, but like I said, my whole yard isn't a food garden. And that's a great resilience of sustainability, but they're not always thinking about that other half of the equation, which is how are they making it good for the other species. And so that's the kind of dialogue I love to see, is where native plant gardeners and food gardeners come together and start thinking about systems, food systems or garden systems, which become regenerative.
Well, I think that's very invigorating to hear you say all that. And here on Love and Revolution Radio, we like to really connect the dots between the personal and the political. And this is such a fertile ground, to make a pun about it, to really explore these connections. That it seems so simple to plant a native plant in your backyard. It seems so small and microscopic compared to the massive industrial complex that has so many forms and faces and is thrusting us off the cliff edge of extinction in the direction that it's going. But here is your real-life personal story of building this corridor of wild plants that not only connects those two parks on either reserves on either side of you, but also a transnational, continental corridor of migrating species. And it reminds me of the effort that went on to actually rebuild the milkweed corridor from Mexico to Canada for the migrating monarch butterflies, which were seriously endangered. And so there was actually an international, state, and local effort to rebuild that milkweed corridor that involved, on the microscopic level, neighbors giving milkweed seeds to other neighbors. And you know, it's kind of this very invigorating understanding that our world is changing so rapidly. And we often think about the negative side of that equation. But on the other hand, in the breakdown is possibly a breakthrough, that we've never actually, as human species, had to really think so deeply and pervasively about why food gardening and wild plant gardening matter to one another. You know, in the old days of human agriculture, we didn't actually monopolize all of the Earth's ecosystem habitat. And so the wild plants were right there in the field next to the smaller acreage of plant of vegetables that we were growing. But now we have to ask these questions, and every single one of us, no matter who we are, has to go through a reskilling and a retraining. And I think this is a very fertile ground, as I said, for our young people, and also not just for our younger people, but for everyone, in finding a portal, so to speak, a gateway, a doorway into the world that's going to come after this time of crisis. If we're going to have a world, it's going to involve these very things that you're talking about. I wanted to ask you a question about how you see this kind of learning being so integrated into these times. This seems like, to me, it's not just knowledge for people who like to garden, but really for everyone in becoming a little piece of the patchwork that rebuilds the ecosystem.
Oh, that's a really hard question. How to help young people learn all of this? I have ideas. I belong to a network of educators who are working on this very question. And in Chicago, some of our biggest institutions are working on it, the Field Museum and the Chicago Botanic Garden and the Morton Arboretum and schools and the Forest Preserve districts. They're all working on, they all have like youth education programs and teen programs, and I forgot the Brookfield too, but they are struggling not because they can't get enough kids to want to join into these programs to learn about nature and conservation and ecology, but because they don't have enough openings for all the kids that really want to be learning about this stuff. And so it's really kind of a bottleneck problem. It's like, how do you get enough funding to help all the kids that really want to learn? And I guess that's a good problem to have, but it's a big question. It's a really big question. And I think it's a question that can be answered bottom up by the way parents bring up their children. It can be answered in school. I believe that all children should learn some systems thinking, because you can't understand ecosystem interactions. Well, nobody actually really does, but I mean, you can't begin to understand how they work unless you can understand how systems work and the ways that all of the interactions go back and forth, and there's, you know, the positive and negative feedback loops and all of that. It's that kind of education that we need to have, and it needs to be, we have to have policies too. And so I don't know about how we'll get to the policy part, but it's got to happen, but it's got to happen from all sectors of society. I mean, we don't really have a lot of time left, honestly. We have enough time, but if we all kind of work together, but we don't have a lot of time. I think that learning to think in systems is probably one of the most important things to teach, and also to teach children about the ecosystem in which they reside. I've had some unusual experiences, and one of the experiences I had teaching was that when I was teaching something like a Shakespeare sonnet that would refer to the Northern Star, or I used to teach some literature courses, a poem that talked about robins, and I'd have to have the students look up how to find the Northern Star, or what, you know, even common birds, what they look like, because when they were walking around, it was just like what we call green blindness, you know, it's just like trees and grass and birds, but not differentiated and certainly not woven into a system. And nobody had ever talked to these students about how a system operates. And so that to me is really, really important.
What this really all comes down to is a willingness for us all to engage sustainable and regenerative ecological interactions, and to develop this awareness that there is no organism that lives in isolation, including human beings. the foods that we're eating do not live in isolation somewhere, completely separate from the rest of the ecosystem, that our individual organisms live together in ecosystems, as you said, that we depend on one another, and we have all of these different types of interactions with each other that are critical for our survival. And some organisms can make their own food and some cannot. Human beings, we obtain our nutrients by eating other organisms. And so having this understanding, growing up with this awareness and this understanding, this is something that I absolutely think our children should be taught, that we have to have an understanding of what all of the organisms within that chain require to exist. And that understanding is critical to our survival as human beings. And this reminds me of the work of somebody that I greatly admire. In fact, I had this experience years ago when I was in college where we had to dress up as one of our heroes, either contemporary or modern historical figure, and come in and talk to the class. They could ask us any question they wanted, talk to the class about from the perspective of that individual. And the person that I dressed up as was Masanobu Fukuoka, who was a Japanese farmer and philosopher who kind of revolutionized this idea of natural farming and revegetation of these desertified lands. And he was a proponent of no-till, no herbicide, grain cultivation farming methods that were traditional to many indigenous cultures, and his crops thrived. They did better than the industrial crops, and he rotated his fields, and he did all of these things that were really in line with these spiritual practices. And one of the things that I think could be a great resource to young people growing up, which is his book, The One Straw Revolution. And it looks at things not only from an ecological, but it's also very philosophical about our relationships and our connections to these systems that we all rely upon for our survival. And the fact that we're not teaching our children these things in school is a great disservice to us all going forward. As you said, we have time, but we don't have a lot of time. And so we have to be involved in this radical movement to kind of take back control of our educational systems and to really engage in these processes of establishing both educational sovereignty and food sovereignty within our small communities in order to be able to set the stage for future sustainability and survival of our species. You know, one of the things that I think is really critical is this understanding that the earth doesn't need us. If we all disappeared as human beings, the earth would survive and thrive and restore and regenerate itself, as would the rest of the natural world. Without the rest of the natural world, we as human beings would not be able to survive. And so understanding that basic premise and understanding all of the concepts that are tied to that are critical to the education of our children. And so as we move forward and we start to look at some of those things, do you have other resources that you can recommend to people that they may be able to use if they want to incorporate some of these teachings into the lives of the young people that are in their communities or in their schools or to educate themselves?
I don't have necessarily resources specifically for children. I know in my own area, in the Chicago region, as I mentioned, our great nature-related institutions, they are great resources as well. The Field Museum, for example, I went to Members Night the other night, and I saw a ton of families. It's where you get to meet the scientists, and they have specimens, and the Field Museum scientists do great work down in the rainforests in South America, and they do collecting work and they curate collections. And so there are these resources that are like that, that we might not even look at. You know, we say, well, we want things to be, we have to separate ourselves or move on. But I guess what I'm saying is some of these institutions themselves recognize this. Like the Chicago Botanic Garden is doing great research into native plants and native seeds, and not just in Illinois. And so if you live near an urban area and you have museums and institutions like that, that's one really good kind of resource. If you live where there are Forest Preserve districts, a lot of times the websites will have family days, they have nature classes, they have all kinds of things like that. If you have a permaculture institute near you, you can learn some good things about food gardening that you might not learn elsewhere. So those are kind of on-the-ground resources. And then I've always learned myself a lot from books and online. I'm a reader, and I grew up reading. You can read classics even, like Thoreau, for example, and people kind of laugh at Thoreau, but he was on with some really important things about how we relate to nature and why we should simplify our lives in order to, I don't know, live a more natural life. Or Aldo Leopold, who again was one of the fathers of modern conservation, and his Sand County Almanac just gives a kind of original philosophical basis for why is nature worth preserving or keeping or having a relationship with. And there's just so many books like that. And resilience.org, which is the outfit I write for, you can just go on to their website anytime and you'll see tons of articles that will lead you in all kinds of interesting different directions regarding resilience and sustainability. And again, if you're talking about organic gardening, the Rodale Institute is pretty good. Some of the other people that I mentioned, such as Eric Tomsmeyer, Toby Hemingway, and those are permaculture folks. But I think that if you pay attention to permaculture principles and that sort of cookie-cutter techniques, that you can learn a very flexible and observant way of understanding the place where you live in order to work with it and garden with it. And so it's really kind of a multi-stranded thing, because it's a question of how do we live, how do we work with other people to make our cities more resilient and more sustainable, how do we understand and interact with wild nature, and how do we make room for wild nature even while we are providing for our own needs and wants. And I think in some ways people might think of those things as being separate issues or parts of different areas of endeavor, but to me they're completely intertwined. And you can't think about green infrastructure in your city and stormwater management without thinking about the river where the water goes and the creatures that live along the river and how that all works together and what your place in all of that is.
It's funny you mentioned the river and the storm water, because Chicago is one of the cool things I learned, or I don't know if it's cool or not, but one of the intriguing things I learned about Chicago is that they have reverse engineered a river to not flow into the lake, which goes against all forms of gravity that you would imagine. So I think there's another solution to the problem of putting the pollution in the lake, and that's probably to stop it at the source. But I want to remind our listeners, because we're getting down to the last minute of our show, that Adrienne Fisher is a sustainability coordinator at her local community college, and she writes and gives talks about regenerative gardening and reconciliation ecology. There are some great YouTube videos with her out there, so do look her up. You can also find her writings on resilience.org. I want to just thank you so much for bringing up so many of these stories and for sharing your personal experiences as well. I want to let the listeners know that all of those resources that Adrienne just mentioned, we will put the links to what's available online so you can study and learn more. You can find those in our weekly email, which you can sign up for on our Love and Revolution page on riverasun.com. You can also find those links in our Podomatic, and I believe the Stitcher post also will have the links that come through. So there's many ways to get connected to resources, and Adrienne, thank you so much for mentioning them all. What is one last thought, just one, maybe two, that you would like the listeners to consider as they're leaving today's show and going on out into the world?
Don't give up hope. And it's very easy to get depressed and unhappy and anxious by all of the bad news that is constantly sweeping in over us through our various electronic means. And a lot of it's very, very depressing. But on the other hand, I think it was Paul Hawken wrote that book, Blessed Unrest. There's millions and millions of people. You know, you're not alone. There's millions of people working on this way of changing and making life better and more resilient. And that's really true. And I used to think I was all by myself. And then I started getting to know people, and I started seeing all of the things that so many people are working on, groups of people and even some governments. So just don't give up hope. Find out what you can do and work on it.
Thanks this week to our guest, Adrian Fisher, and to my co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, is also performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
Well, thank you to my co-host, Sherry Mitchell. You can follow Sherry Mitchell on her Sacred Instructions Facebook page. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Stitcher, iTunes, and Podomatic.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. We had an engaging conversation today with Adrian Fisher. You might recall that we recently interviewed Sweetwater Nanook, who told us to go out into our local communities and to learn from and to engage with and to introduce ourselves to the native peoples that were the original inhabitants of those lands. Adrian is charging us with a new task. She's asking us to go out into our local environment and to get to know the biodiversity that is indigenous to those lands and to find ways to make those lands more habitable for them. If we do this, we can all learn to live in harmony with one another, and we can continue to exist into the future, which is the goal after all. So maybe you'll take the time to go out and to